Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Clare, the Fife College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Fife College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest book just out, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
I'm pleased to be back again.
And clearly, Michael, there are two things going on here. The price of gasoline, which has made the president vulnerable for re-election, arguably it's the strongest suit that the Republicans have, assuming they will eventually pick their nominee. And then you've got this speculation going on Wall Street that people I've spoken to have recently say that it basically is about a third of the cost of what we pay at the pump is due to Wall Street speculation, which is the most predatory and unproductive thing imaginable, particularly at a time when we're in an economic recovery. But then if you step back into a broader frame, what you're saying in the race for what's left, the global scramble for the world's last resources is what?
Well, what I'm saying is that we're in a new geological epoch or a new resource epoch, in the sense that all of the easy oil has now been depleted permanently. The oil that's very cheap to produce and cheap to refine and cheap to deliver, that's now gone. So all that's left on the planet is very expensive oil, tough oil to develop. And that's what we're relying on. Deep offshore oil, Arctic oil, oil derived from difficult geological formations like Canadian tar sands and shale oil, and oil derived from war zones, and that jacks up the price as well. And this is a permanent factor. Doesn't matter if Wall Street gets involved or the war situation in Iran calms down, that'll bring prices down a bit, but we're increasingly relying on increasingly expensive oil to produce, and that will never change. That's irreversible.
So I hate to quote Newt Gingrich because he's so off the wall, but the other night in his speech where he lost in both Mississippi and Alabama, but nevertheless is soldiering on and clearly is helping Mitt Romney by splitting the conservative vote, he talked about how, you know, he's made this absurd claim that he could get gas down to $2 a gallon. And he went on and on about North Dakota having billions and billions of gallons of oil. What the hell's he talking about?
He's talking about the Bakken or Bakken formation in North Dakota. And he gives the impression that there's giant reservoirs of oil like there used to be in Texas, and you drill down and oil comes spurting out. And this is a complete figment of his imagination. What there is a mammoth formation of shale rock, and the only way you could get that oil out is to fracture that formation with millions and millions of gallon of chemically laced water. And you have to drill thousands, hundreds of thousands of drills down into that rock and shatter it mile after mile after mile. There's no pool of oil. There are molecules of oil embedded in hard shale rock. And yes, you could get it out, but it's going to cost a fortune. It's going to have mammoth environmental consequences. And in the end, we're never going to get as much oil out of there that he's fantasizing about.
Well, isn't that pretty much what's happening with the Canadian tar sands, that we don't factor in the enormous amount of water that's used? The water has to be heated, and these high-pressure steam hoses separate the tar from the sand. And then all of the runoff water, billions and billions of gallons, exponentially growing every day, and then all this brackish oil-laced water that's ruined, it can't be used for anything, is then stored in these vast pools. And we're going to get to a point in Canada where the value of the water may well be greater than the value of the oil.
Exactly, Ian. The cost of producing Canadian tar sands is rising steadily because the Canadians are beginning to worry about the ultimate risk to their environment, and they're demanding higher environmental standards. And this means the cost of production is rising. And so it costs now $60, $70, $80, $90 a barrel to produce that stuff at a minimum. And so there's no way that you could bring the price of gasoline down. If the price of gasoline drops, then there'll be no incentive to produce that stuff. And, of course, we're not talking about the environmental consequences. Listen, the only way to get the price of oil down today is to have peace in the Middle East, and I mean permanent peace, some kind of rapprochement with Iran. Iran gives up its nuclear weapons program. The U.S. Makes some kind of permanent accord in that region. Then the speculators will be out of business. But I can't imagine that happening in any immediate time frame.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His latest book just out is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. So you've got new players in the energy market, China being the biggest one, and its demand is getting close to the US's. And I just noticed that the South Sudan, where China has invested billions and billions, have just cut off the oil supply, which goes through the north of Sudan, which is broken off with this new country, South Sudan, which and the north, the leaders in the north, all of whom are indicted by the International Criminal Court, are up to their old tricks, genocide being their main foreign policy instrument, it seems, to the point now where the South Sudanese have cut off the oil supply to the Chinese. That represents apparently 6% of China's daily demand. They've also, of course, invested hugely in the infrastructure to get the oil out of Sudan. Is this an indicator that China is going to have to play a more active role in international affairs?
Well, China has already begun to play a much more aggressive role in seeking out the available supplies of petroleum, especially in Africa. Sudan is one of the places. They're also very active in Angola and Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea, and they're going to have to step up their search. They're becoming more active in the Western Hemisphere, in Venezuela and Brazil and in Central Asia. They're very active in Kazakhstan and in Russia. So China's need for oil is becoming insatiable, and this is going to be a very dominant factor in the world's oil market. And it's the other big reason why oil prices are rising. We like to think in this country that we're the only consumers of oil. Now we're facing very stiff competition from China and India soon to come, and they're competing with us for this diminishing supply of oil, and that's why prices are rising. Nothing that we could do about that.
Well, if you look, and your book deals with the BP disaster in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and it turns out, without revisiting that whole catastrophe, that BP was pushing the envelope along with Halliburton and Deepwater Horizon. But the fact is that BP has been paying off enormous debts, none of which I think are adequate, but they nevertheless are, which gives you an idea of the kind of money these oil companies have. And then when you look at what they're building up in the Arctic, these man-made islands and these unbelievably expensive platforms, what are we talking about in terms of the investments now being made to get this riskier, more difficult to get oil?
Well, indeed, Ian, as you say, this is the future of oil, these very expensive, very risky investments in the Arctic and offshore in deep waters. This summer, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is expected to start drilling in offshore Alaska in deeper waters, not just the man-made islands, but offshore rigs like they used in the Gulf of Mexico, now in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea. I think this is very risky because any spill there would be far more catastrophic than in the Gulf of Mexico, which is relatively robust in its ability to overcome an oil spill. That's not true in the Arctic, where the flora and fauna are at much greater risk. And I worry, too, about offshore Brazil. This is the biggest new discovery of the 21st century, the pre-salt fields off of Rio de Janeiro. Much more complex task of getting oil out of there will require rigs far more expensive. They're talking about a expense of $250 billion, and I'm afraid you're going to have much more risky conditions there than you have in the Gulf of Mexico. They've already started having spills in offshore Brazil, and I think that's just the beginning of what we'll see.
So again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His latest book just out is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. So I think we covered pretty much, covered the notion that in your book you quote the CEO of Chevron, David O'Reilly, saying that one thing is clear, the era of easy oil is over. Now we're into the era of difficult oil and dangerous oil, dangerous to the environment because they're going to extremes to get it. So we can look forward to more Deepwater Horizon disasters. I think that's a fair prediction. On the other side, demand, what is being done? Because the more I talk about this with you, the more it reminds me of the war on drugs, you know, the insanity of all those people in Mexico dying because we have such a bad habit in this country, and we also have a bad oil habit in this country. When are we going to get off this dangerous drug?
It's hard for me to say. You know, obviously, as prices rise, this is going to force more people to use public transit where that's an option, where that's even an option. It's going to force people to give up their gas guzzlers for smaller, more efficient cars, and that's a step in the right direction. But it's going to take some greater effort to see a total switch away from petroleum to other fuels. But that's essentially what it's going to take in the long run.
What about the idea that so much of at least the demand due to automobiles and trucks, which is a huge part of oil demand, what about a battery? I mean, I'm astounded at what happened recently with the Chevy Volt. There were negative stories. I don't know where they came from. There's nothing wrong with that car. But General Motors is now having, they've got a surplus of them, you know? I mean, how is it possible that when you make a breakthrough and start delivering cars that don't pollute, somehow or other the public is turned off?
Well, you know, it's always true that new technology carries with it a certain amount of risk because it hasn't been perfected. That was true with the internal combustion engine in its early days. But, you know, what you have to bear in mind is that all of these technologies involve the use of resources that are scarce. The hybrid car and the all-electric cars depend on a lot of rare earths and lithium. These are also scarce resources which are disappearing and which are going to cause a lot of conflict in the future, just like oil and other sources of energy. So the solution is not to make a better car, but to think about alternative forms of transportation altogether. That's really the only long-term solution.
So you mean vast investments in public transport, which, by the way, most of the rest of the world, the Europeans and Australians and others, have much, much more developed public transportation. I guess it's the same is true in Brazil and other countries. What's
indeed,
the problem here?
Or,
what's
no,
the problem
you can
in the
think about producing cars that get 100 miles per gallon. The technology to do that is certainly available. If we have smaller, lighter cars, they don't have to be made out of steel. They could be made out of other products that are much lighter, so you don't need to use so much fuel. That technology is within reach. In Europe, they have vehicles that get 75 miles per gallon as a matter of course. Why we don't have that, I don't quite understand, but That's another way to go.
What explains our lack of investment in public transportation?
I think this is due to a combination of factors, the efforts of the oil and the highway construction lobbies and the automobile lobbies to promote urban sprawl, suburban sprawl, and we've all become accustomed to that. I understand the appeal that everybody wants to have a house on an acre of land, and we've been living our life. That's been promoted as the American dream, and many people are wedded to that dream. I don't want to dismiss it. I think it's not necessarily the best thing for the American family. I think that with the long commutes that people have to live that dream, it doesn't necessarily bring families together. I think it brings them apart. I think when we find ourselves living in more tightly knit communities around public transportation, we'll discover that that's actually a better thing. But we have to re-envision the American dream in a new way that's more tightly packed around public transit. And that's really the issue. It's not just cars and transit. It's the way we live our communities. We have to re-envision American communities in a new way.
Well, surely, though, I'm puzzled, though, why the oil company executives, we just quoted this, the CEO of Chevron, saying that the era of easy oil's over. Why are they investing so much money in lies and greenwashing? And why aren't they educating the American people about what they understand?
Look, they sell oil. That is their business. They have gas stations all over the country and refineries and pipelines. I mean, you can't blame them. That's what they do. They have a product. They want to sell it. They're the pusher man, and we're the customer, and that's the business they want to promote. And, as long as we go along with that and buy their product, we're part of that process. We have to become customers for alternative products. And then their business model will collapse.
So there's no way that you could ask them to be less short-sighted and more with a longer view, that they'd like to stretch this resource out?
No, that's not what they're in business for. I mean, there are people in Silicon Valley and other parts of California and the Pacific Northwest who have a different concept of energy around renewables, wind power, solar power, alternative forms of transportation based on electricity, who are developing whole new concepts of how to deliver energy and transportation that are going to offer us new products. And when we turn en masse to those alternative products, then the oil companies will either go out of business or they'll join the stampede to the new energy products. But so long as they have customers for oil, that's all they're going to do.
Well, just in closing, Michael Clare, what do you think is... I would have thought that the Deepwater Horizon would have been a big wake-up call for the American people, as the Santa Barbara oil spill was years ago. Earth Day was created and an environmental consciousness arose out of that. I don't see much, of a reaction to what happened with the Deepwater Horizon. So does that mean something incredibly catastrophic is going to have to happen before people recognize that we can't go on pushing the envelope on this planet, searching for this increasingly scarce resource and taking greater and greater risks with our environment?
Well, Ian, I think what we're going to have is a slow emergency and big catastrophes occurring repeatedly. I mean, we have a slow emergency right now, which is high oil prices, and this will force people to alter their behavior, not because of a green consciousness or a concern over the environment or the climate or anything like that, because they can't afford to pay for it. And they're going to make decisions based out of practical need. They'll trade in their SUVs for something else. So there's a slow emergency underway. But there will be more catastrophes, environmental catastrophes ahead, and that will prompt more changes of this sort in time. There's no question about it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Clare.
It's been my pleasure, Ian, always.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest, just out, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing.
Bye for now.